listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The president just gave a speech on energy. We'll get into that. I think it's a great start. I personally would like a carbon tax, you know, but I understand he hasn't gone there. And the Supreme Court has gutted, and gutted is the word that the Huffington Post is using, and I think it's a perfect word, the Voting Rights Act. This is amazing. So our question, were voting rights just sent to the back of the bus? And for that matter, should the Supreme Court even have this kind of power? Here's what Eric Holder had to say about this today.
After extensive hearings, sections 4 and 5 of this important law were reauthorized, most recently in 2006, just 7 years ago, with the unanimous support of the United States Senate and the near-unanimous support of the House of Representatives. This is a uniquely legislative function and responsibility that the Constitution expressly gave to Congress.
There you go. So Joe Madison is with me, host of the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM, weekdays 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Channel 110. His website, joemadison.com, and Twitter at Black Eagle Power, at Black Eagle Power. Yeah. Joe, hey.
And soon to, I guess, put on my activist hat, because clearly what this decision by the Supreme Court is going to require is for us to form now coalitions.
Yes.
And demand of Congress that they reinstate this, that they do what they did in 2006, because it clearly now is in the hands of Congress. You know, it's a devastating decision, but before, and I don't call them conservatives anymore, I've come up with a new term. They're the opposite of progressive. Regressives.
There you go.
That's exactly what they are. This takes us back to pre-1965. That's regressive.
Yeah.
But what I think before the far right, the regressives start to celebrate, they need to be very careful, because what the Supreme Court said is that the Congress has to remap this. Mm-hmm. They now have to look at the jurisdictions. Society has changed. You know, votes are, the people are voting now more than they've ever voted before. Although I hasten to add that when they talk about African Americans voting more than whites in certain states, and you look at states like Texas, there's no statewide African American elected. Mm-hmm. Georgia, Alabama. Most of these states, you know, do not have African Americans who have won statewide elections. Mississippi, you just had a gubernatorial race there, and the African American who ran was soundly defeated, I would say in large part because he was African American. There might be folks who would say other reasons. But look what happened in Wisconsin, voter ID. Right. Ohio, voter suppression. Right. Pennsylvania, voter suppression. Congress could look at those states.
Yeah, or look at what's going on in Michigan and Detroit,
Michigan,
and Flint, and Baton Harbor.
That's absolutely right. And could look at those states and say, okay, maybe we'll take away Alabama, but we're going to add Michigan.
Right.
See, you could add, with this decision, you could add these states. But the bottom line is we're going to have to get busy. This is a coalition of whites, blacks, Native Americans, Asians, Latinos, particularly Latinos. So this is where we now have to demand of Congress that they do the right thing immediately. And we don't have until 2023 to do it. This has to be done now.
At the same time, though, you've got a House of Representatives that is controlled by Boehner and Cantor and the Republicans, and their religion is voter suppression. I mean, this is, down in Florida in 2000, you know, knocking 60, 80, 90,000 African Americans off the voting rolls before the voting even started.
That's right.
Gives George Bush the presidency.
Yeah, you remember you had a former Republican chairman in Florida.
Right.
I think I had him on my program twice, who said he walks into a meeting, there are paid consultants, and they're talking about voter suppression.
Right.
How to prevent African Americans from voting, suppressing their vote. And they were paying these consultants to do that. And he became a whistleblower. And of course, he was kicked out of the out of his position and probably kicked out of the Republican Party. I mean, you look at the modern day attempts to suppress the vote, this voter ID, because we want to prevent voter fraud. And there is, what, 0.00001% of voter fraud in most of the states, in essence, non-existent.
Yeah. More people die falling in their bathtub.
Yeah, exactly. You've
fraud.
Got it, Tom. You've got it.
In fact, the last number I saw, more people die having their television fall on them.
Really?
Than commit voter fraud.
Can I use that on my
Please
show?
Please do. I've been using it on my TV show for about a year.
No, I mean, it's a decision. I must tell you, a lot of people, particularly in the civil rights community, are disappointed, but in all honesty, they weren't terribly surprised. Right. The person that disappoints me more than anyone is Clarence Thomas, who's from the state of Georgia, who, by the way, we spent most of our morning talking about his concurrent decision that he issued in reference to Fisher versus the University of Texas, Austin, where he keeps his Yale college degree with a 15-cent stamp on it because he says it was only worth 15 cents.
Well, he used affirmative action to get into college.
Well, he was given an, you know, here's the argument about this.
Sure.
You and I go to college together.
Right.
Maybe they give me an opportunity, but they give me an opportunity to compete. No one at Washington University, St. Louis, ever handed me an affirmative action exam.
There you go.
No one.
There you go.
Damn it, I had to go to the same lectures.
Yeah.
I had to fill out the – in those days, we didn't have computers. We had to fill – remember the old blue thing?
Yeah.
I had to do the same essays. Yeah. I had to compete in the same classroom.
Yeah.
But do you think that when he got his law degree, do you think when he was being sworn – when he was being vetted and confirmed – that he suggested that was affirmative action law degree? Matter of fact, let me tell you an honest-to-goodness story. I was on the board of the NAACP. They wanted the NAACP's endorsement. Benjamin Hooks was supporting Bush's nomination of Clarence Thomas. The board was divided. We sent a committee to go talk to Clarence Thomas about his position, and particularly on issues like affirmative action. He sat there and told a committee, a delegation that went to his home, that he was 100% behind affirmative action.
Really?
Yes. And I can name the people who went to the home. And when they came back to report to the 64-member board, that was one of the first questions asked. What is his position on affirmative action? And he said he was 100% for it.
And now he's gone 100% David Koch.
He lied. Yeah. He just simply lied to get the endorsement. And here's a man from Georgia.
Well, I guess it shows that there are people who don't have integrity of all races.
That's right. Well, that's simply it. And in such a close decision, 5-4. But I think that this is maybe with the anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington, maybe this is the time now for all of us to show up like they did in 1963. And show up by the hundreds of thousands. Can you imagine what would happen if we all showed up in that anniversary, that famous anniversary 50 years ago?
Yeah, we could do something.
We
More
could do something.
With Joe Madison right after this. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out Joe's website at joemadison.com. More with Joe Madison in just a second. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Joe Madison in the studio with us. Pleasure and honor to have you, my friend.
Section 4?
Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution of the United States.
Okay.
It says, The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. So, like, you know, if you and I sued each other, it's got to, you know, go back and forth, court to court to court, but somebody's got to be the final court.
Right.
Say, okay, Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
Hmm.
Now, in Federalist 81, Hamilton made it very clear. They were putting the Supreme Court under, you know, in the leash of Congress. He said the Supreme Court will be the least likely to cause mischief. They have no police force. They have no power to tax. They have no power to spend. They basically, it's just the final court of appeals.
Wait a minute. How long ago, Tom, was the court being criticized for being an activist court?
Yeah.
You remember that?
You remember that? Whenever they wanted to do something for the people.
Oh, they're an activist court.
The Warren Court.
My goodness. What happened today?
Yeah.
That's exactly what they did. Hey, forget it. You guys, you know, this doesn't count. You've got to go back. And matter of fact, you've got to redo everything. You know, now let's keep in mind, they didn't say Section 5 was unconstitutional. Right. Robert's argument was very interesting. Robert's argument was times have changed. We're not the same nation we were in 1965. Now, you know, I always make the point. You're right. It's no longer Jim Crow, but it's James Crow Esquire.
There you go.
I mean, there's still a culture. Even when we had the 65 Voting Rights Act, it wasn't a walk in the park. I mean, you know, states argued it, they fought it, and they still are fighting it. So, but we won. And I think that I'm not panicking at this point in time. I think that even though this is the only thing that worries me, and I think I heard you mentioning it about this Congress.
Mm.
This is not the 2006 Congress.
No.
This is an entire, I heard someone the other day, heard someone this morning say, they're not certain that this Congress is mature enough to do what has to be done.
Also, you know, there's a certain amount of Nixon going to China in this. You know, Nixon could go to China and not be accused of being a communist. If it had been a Democrat, it would have been a game changer. You know, it would have been the end of that Democrat's career. George Bush could get the Voting Rights Act signed. Barack Obama is going to be criticized by the racist white. Right.
But here's the other thing, I'm not certain who mentioned this earlier today when we were on, and that is that President Obama has got to own this.
Yep.
I'm curious where the outrage is because
these guys are saying, you know, Holden and Obama both today said, I'm disappointed. I think they should be saying, I got smoke coming out of my ears, damn it. I'm going to pull a Harry Truman here.
Harry Truman and a Johnson. Because these senators want something. Yeah. They all do. They all want something. I'm going to tell you something. I would hold them up because Barack Obama has to understand he would not be president of the United States if it wasn't for Section 4, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. He's got to own this. And some people say, well, one of the things he needs to do is put together a commission of bipartisan governors and try to work it out. Okay, maybe that'll work. You're shaking your head.
I'm thinking it's too slow. We're going into an election
in
which the Republicans, there's a very real possibility in 2014 that the Republicans will lose the House of Representatives. And if they do, then the Voting Rights Act will be passed tomorrow morning.
This is where all the progressives, middle of the road, white, black, this really should be a nonpartisan issue. This really should be.
And
the Tea Party can, you know, this is where we overcome them. This is where we have our own tea party. This is where we dress up like Indians and start throwing the tea overboard. Yeah. This is what we're going to have to do because this strikes at the very heart of our democracy. And President Obama has got to own this. He's got to own it.
And if he doesn't,
then he's a major disappointment.
He's also setting up the loss of the 2014 election.
Yeah, he's
the Democrats.
He's not only doing that, but he may be introducing the end of the second Reconstruction.
Yeah.
Now, if people know their history, they know what happened at the end of the first Reconstruction, and it took us 100 years almost 100
You're
years.
You're talking about Plessy v. Ferguson?
I'm talking about Plessy v. Ferguson. I'm talking about, you have to remember, at the turn of the 20th century, the last African-American to serve in the United States Congress. You had the introduction of grandfather clause. You had you had the very rules that brought about the 65 Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
You know, look, we're looking at the first African-American senator. I was over at the Senate the other day. Do you know there's only been 8 African-American United States senators?
It's amazing.
8. And, excuse me, 4 of them were appointed.
And that's a building that was built by African-Americans.
Yeah, the whole Capitol, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of all the U.S. senators, only 8 have served in that body, and 4 of them were appointed.
We need to be doing something about this. And
oh, right now, yes.
Yeah, and to our white viewers.
Oh, this is not a...
Let's get active. I mean,
yeah,
this is time for coalition building.
This is not even...
It's not partisan politics. It's not even ultimately racial politics. It's what's right for America politics. It's
No. Ifs, ands, buts about it. You just said it the best that I could. That's why I said it's it has to be coalition politics now. And this is where we all have to come together. And I agree with you. You said it right. It has to be immediately. That's why I'm saying I think the best target date would be in August, on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. This gives us now a theme this summer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's Joe Madison. JoeMadison.com is website. Twitter at Black Eagle Power. Be back. Thank you, Joe. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. This decision is, you know, for lack of a better word, insane. If there was ever a case that demonstrated the need to roll back Marbury versus, well, I'll get into that in a second. Shane O'Farnan is with us, the Supreme Court reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and also our producer here on the radio, on our radio program here on the Tom Hartman program, one of our producers, Shane, welcome.
Thank you.
You were in the Supreme Court
today. I was in the Supreme Court today, and it was interesting because Justice Ginsburg had a very interesting dissent. She was echoing what you and Joe were talking about in terms of this is really not what Congress should be doing.
You mean not what the Supreme Court should be
doing? The Supreme Court should be doing. This is more for Congress. And when we first spoke about this case together, when it was argued, we talked about how what Shelby brought this lawsuit just because they didn't like the law. Remember that? There wasn't actually...
Oh, that's right. They shouldn't have even gotten standing.
Right. There wasn't some situation where they said, we want to change our voting laws to this, and they went for approval, and they were declined, thus giving it what you call a case in controversy that right. can then be appealed. They just said, district court, we don't like this. And then it was appealed, and that's how it got to the Supreme Court. It's what's called a facial challenge that usually, and Justice Ginsburg pointed this out, the Supreme Court doesn't take these cases and certainly doesn't overrule Congress on them.
Right.
And you know, she asked the question from the bench. She said, I want to use the right term, what happened to the court's usual restraint? She said, Congress went through and they had lots of hearings, tons of documents. The 15th Amendment says this is what Congress should be doing. And they did it. They enacted the law. And now the court is just substituting its own reasoning for that of Congress's. And she said it shouldn't be doing it. And 3 other justices joined her, 5-4. And I want to note that Justice Thomas went further. He wrote a concurring opinion that said, not only would I strike down Section 4, I would strike down Section 5. Saying that
Justice Clarence Thomas, who got into law school as a consequence of affirmative action.
Right.
Although, as Joe Madison points out, that should not in any way diminish his accomplishment graduating from law school. There are no affirmative action exams.
Right.
In law school.
Nor bar exams or any of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, this is one of those cases where what you talk about so much, Marbury versus Madison, is so blindingly apparent. that this is the court has gone too far.
Right. Yeah. That's you know, in for those who don't know what Shane and I are talking about, in 1803, the United States Supreme Court decided that they had the power to strike down a law. In this case, it was the Judiciary Act of 1789. Was it 89?
I believe so.
1789. And they struck it down. And
part of it.
Jefferson, you're part of it. Yeah. Jefferson just went nuts and said, you know, if this decision stands and the Constitution has become a thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary. And I think that that was the beginning. I mean, the only other time they did it before the Civil War was in Dred Scott, which was another dreadful decision. Just kind of the mirror image of Citizens United. Dred Scott, they decided that people were property. Citizens United, they decided that property is people. But this is, in my mind, just a clear example of why the power to strike down laws should be stripped from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court should not have that authority. And although, yeah. Shane, you would say good luck on that, right?
You could, yeah. It is the foundation of law and law schools and what is taught. It's in, we are all indoctrinated with it when we go through law school. It will not change anytime soon.
Yeah.
Although, if you get enough of these decisions, maybe it will.
I got to tell you, I sat down about a year ago with the chief legal aide to a very progressive senator. And, you know, we were talking about a piece of legislation that they were drafting, and I was just kind of lobbying for it. And I don't know how the topic came up, but I said, you know, I don't think the Supreme Court has the right to review law.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, he looked at me like I had just said, you know, there's a flying saucer out in the front lawn.
Yeah. Well, but you know, the thing is that this case is clearly too far. Marbury versus Madison, I still ascribe to, because that's a situation in which you had a constitutional provision, and then Congress enacted a law that completely contradicted that constitutional provision.
Right.
And they said one has to win, and they said the Constitution does. In this case, it isn't like there was a constitutional provision.
There's nothing in the Constitution that was contradicted by the Voting Rights
Act. Sure, because the Constitution sets out. Oh, well, exactly. That's why it's different here. The Constitution doesn't say, Congress, you shouldn't be doing this. In fact, it says quite the antithesis. So they went further than something like Marbury versus Madison, where Marbury was, here's a constitutional provision, Congress went contrary to it. Here, there's a constitutional provision, and Congress went directly in line with it, and they still overruled it.
Right, the constitutional provision being the 15th Amendment.
Right. Now, they cited the 10th Amendment, saying this is the province for the states. You shouldn't treat states differently, and states should be able to govern themselves when it comes to voting.
So that was the rationale for this?
It was.
It was a Tenther case?
It was a Tenther case, but they said in the past we could go past the 10th Amendment simply because the discrimination was so extreme that it was so ingrained that there was only by using an extraordinary remedy could we fix it. But now the things have changed, voila.
Yeah,
now that it's not so bad anymore. They did acknowledge that discrimination still exists, that no one should doubt that.
I think Joe said it brilliantly when he said, you know, Jim Crow may not be around anymore, but James Crow Esquire is with
absolutely, without a doubt. But what they were saying is because the problem isn't as bad, we don't need this extreme anti-10th Amendment solution,
right,
is what they were saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, Shano, thank you.
You are welcome.
Great to have you with us. And let us not forget, oh, by the way, President Putin was in Finland, I believe, either Finland or Denmark. I'm pretty sure it was Finland today, and for something completely unrelated to anything that has to do with Edward Snowden. But he held a press conference, and of course, somebody said, you know, is Ed Snowden in Russia, and are your spies shaking him down for what he knows about what the NSA was doing with regard to Russia? And Putin said he's not in Russia. He's in the Moscow airport in the transit area, which is not considered the sovereign. Now, I'm not even paraphrasing. I'm just telling you the essence of what he said. These are not his words, but you know, the transit area is essentially not arguably a sovereign property, but it's not considered as such. Transit areas, you can pass through a transit area without a visa to enter the country because you haven't formally entered the country yet. You do that when you go through passport control, and then you're on the land of the country. So he said, you know, he's there, but you know, he's in an international kind of stateless zone. And by the way, We respect that notion. Countries all over the world respect that notion. It's the way that refugees can travel. It's the way that people without visas who are just simply transiting through a country. You know, if somebody wants to fly from Europe, from France to Brazil, and they don't have a visa into the United States, they can still fly through Kennedy Airport or through Dulles Airport. They just can't leave the airport transit zone. And so President Putin said, no, he's not in Russia. He's just at the airport. And no, our spies are not, shaking down his laptops. I find it so hysterical that the press keeps saying he's got four laptops, as if that's like, you know, four laptops worth of secrets. First of all, I doubt he has four laptops. I mean, this is the 21st century. He probably has one, maybe a backup, but, you know, four, really? Why not just have a couple of extra spare hard drives or thumb drives, for that matter? So, anyhow, but it's like,
yeah, he's got all this guy. He's a super spy. He's got all these secrets. It's just incredible.
And then I think that President Putin was responding, that is just my personal opinion, was responding in a way to how John Kerry and commentators on the right, and frankly, even Chuck Schumer, have gone after him. If you are asking an ally to do you a favor, you don't do it at the same time you're saying, why'd Snowden go there? They don't have freedom of the press. They're crummy country. By the way, will you help us, please, crummy country? You get it? I mean, you know, Holder did this. The president did this. Jay Carney did this. Numerous members of Congress did this. Basically said what I just said.
Why would he go to a repressive country that doesn't have freedom of speech if he really believes in freedom of speech? Oh, by the way, repressive country, will you please help us out?
And then they say, no, I don't think so. And we're all shocked. Shocked! Hong Kong's official response, by the way, to the United States' request for extradition included, by the way, we'd like to have a conversation with you about the revelations that Mr. Snowden has shared with the world while he was here in Hong Kong. Not with us. He didn't share them with the government. He shared them through Glenn Greenwald via the press, through The Guardian. He shared them with the world as a reporter's source, not as a spy. The revelations that y'all in America have been spying on us here in Hong Kong. We would like to have a conversation about that. So, anyhow, we'll see where this goes. We'll see where this goes. But I think that now is the time, really, if there ever was a time for Congress to say, okay, that's it. We are going to actually start to exercise oversight over the Supreme Court. We're going to regulate the Supreme Court as Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution requires or authorizes at the very least. Now is the time. Come on, Congress. Now, I don't expect John Boehner to do it, frankly, but I'm still calling for it. Not only pass a new, you know, Article 4 of the Voting Rights Act, but also pass something saying that the Supreme Court doesn't have the power to decide these kind of cases.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or, frankly, to decide any kind of case based on constitutionality. They're the final court of appeals. Read your constitution. Welcome back. Kevin in Storm Lake, Iowa. Hey, Kevin, you wanted to talk about Marbury versus Madison?
Well, I just wanted to kind of see where you're coming from. I guess what I'm wanting to know is what's to prevent, I mean, who decides that, you know, say, for example, that Congress would pass some onerous law that, you know, something really ridiculous that, you know, but as an example, you know, that would discriminate against somebody.
You mean like legalizing, for example, slavery?
Well, something, yeah.
Which the Supreme Court went along with for 70 years?
Yeah, I'm just saying, doesn't there have to be a final arbiter to determine whether a law is discriminatory or
yes.
just unconstitutional?
Yes, absolutely. After Marbury versus Madison was decided and the Supreme Court said that they were the final arbiter, Jefferson said, and I quote, If this opinion be sound, then indeed has our Constitution become a complete felo de so, legally a suicide. The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape in any form they please. My construction of the Constitution is very different from what you quote from this decision. It is that each department is truly independent of others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the cases submitted to its actions. A judiciary independent of a king or executive alone is a good thing, but independent of the will of the nation is a solecism, which is a word, an old word that means blunder or error, at least in a Republican government. And so then, you know, Spencer Roan wrote back to Jefferson saying, well, if the Supreme Court doesn't decide what is the meaning of the Constitution, or, you know, if a law has been passed as unconstitutional, who does? And Jefferson's response was very simple: the people themselves. And that's how the Constitution is written. The power to decide what is constitutional is not, you will not find it in Article 3 section, you will not find it in Article 3 of the Constitution at all. You know, I defy anybody to call in and say, okay, here, I found it. It's, here it is. No, it's not. Article 1 establishes the courts, right? Including the Supreme Court. Article 2 talks about which court, you know, it talks about the Supreme Court and where their power lies. And so the judicial power to all laws and all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, treaties made or which shall be made to all cases affecting ambassadors, public ministers and consuls, admiralty and maritime, controversies between the states, controversies between two or more states, between citizens of different states, between citizens of a state claiming land under grants of different states. And, you know, in other words, these are areas where the normal courts don't have jurisdiction. So we're going to give this jurisdiction to the Supreme Court. And then in the second in article, there was Article 3, and then you get to Section 2, Sentence 2, in all cases affecting ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In other words, it's the only court you can go to. It's the first and final court you can go to. In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. You know what that is. That's the final court of appeals, right? You can appeal to that.
Right, right.
In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court, I'm reading verbatim from the Constitution, in all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with, in other words, they can determine, yes, this person broke this law, this is what that law means, and, or we're going to decide to throw this evidence out, or we're going to accept this evidence, both as to law and effect, and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make.
Well, I guess what my point is, to me, you know, Congress can make a law with a simple, I mean, not right now, but with a simple majority.
Yes.
And just use it as an extravagant example that somebody, you know, with 51% of a vote, they could pass some really onerous law.
Like the Patriot Act.
Because
that steps all over the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, because
I'm saying they've already done that. And the way that should be reversed is not by appealing it to the Supreme Court. The way that should be reversed is by you and me. It should be by the people themselves. It should be by us saying, I don't want a Congress that's going to vote for the Patriot Act. And I will not vote for a politician who voted for the Patriot Act. And so, you know, what you do is you change the composition of Congress, and then Congress passes a new law that is constitutional rather than the Patriot Act, which, in my opinion, is unconstitutional, and or the NDAA, which is, in my opinion, was unconstitutional. The power should be with us, Kevin.
Oh, I understand that, but I'm just saying I guess I kind of look to the Supreme Court as the one that should be protecting the rights of people. I mean,
no, you're talking about a benevolent kingdom, and you want the Supreme Courts to be the benevolent king. And the problem is, A, the United States wasn't set up as a constitutional monarchy. There is no king who is the ultimate authority. The ultimate authority is we the people, the first three words of the Constitution.
Now, I understand that.
And we exercise that authority every 2 years by elections. And so, A, and B, we actually don't need there to be, you know, people in high places who have lifetime appointments, who are not even elected, who are making the final decisions on our laws. That's a monarchy. You're asking for a king.
No, I'm not.
You absolutely are. In a constitutional, this is how constitutional monarchies work. If the Queen of England decides that she doesn't like how things are going, she dissolves Parliament. She can strike down laws. She can say, okay, that's it, no more. I'm the king. I'm the queen. But in the United States, the whole idea was there's no king or queen.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I'm just trying to get an angle on this. I understand that, you know, that people need to get in there and take care of this thing. But I'm looking at a time frame where
from 1787 when the Constitution was presented, 1789 I guess when it was ratified, 1791 when it was amended. From then until the Civil War, there were only two times that the Supreme Court used this power to strike down things based on the Constitution. Once was Marbury v. Madison in 1803 when they seized the power, and the other was in 1856 in Dred Scott when they declared that slavery was in the Constitution. And that led to the Civil War. I would argue that the Supreme Court having this kind of power has not been a good thing for the United States. And now they're using it instead of, you know, once every 50 years, now they're using it 50 times a year. They're using it on virtually every case they decide. And it's not in the Constitution. It's wrong. Kevin, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio on the line with us, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, the website. Hey, Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, my friend?
Good.
So, boy, there's a lot going on since the last time we talked a week or so ago. The Supreme Court today, I think if there was ever a case that illustrates the insanity of Marbury v. Madison, today was that case.
Yes.
The Supreme Court, I mean, the original case in this is, as Shane O'Farnan, our Supreme Court reporter, who was in the Supreme Court this morning when this came down, as pointed out by Justice Ginsburg, the original case was an objection that shouldn't have even had standing. The original case was simply, you know, they did not demonstrate that they were harmed by this law. All they demonstrated was that they didn't like it.
Well, they reached. You saw them do the same thing with Citizens United, where they reach out for the opportunity to be able to review because they know that they can cause more harm. But this case, I think people are looking at and not understanding kind of the underpinning of it. This is truly a corporate America kind of ruling that comes from the corporate America go-to guys on the Supreme Court there, the five that always rule for corporate America. Here's how it works. Corporate America, it's very clear. If you look at anything written by the Chamber of Commerce, created by Associated Industries, they have a direct benefit in keeping Republicans in office. This is not me talking. This has been study after study where they go back and they say, where does corporate America line up politically? Is it blue or is it red? And the reason it's red is because they're always there to bail corporate America out. So these judges that ruled this are there because of corporate America. They rule in favor of corporate America probably in the neighborhood of 90. I've seen anywhere between 92 to 95% of the time. So tying that up, we understand this. Democrats win. Corporate America loses. That's the notion of how corporate America views elections. They don't really care about the social issues. They care how does it affect the bottom line. Add to that, Tom, the demographics changes with Latinos, with African Americans, with young voters. All of a sudden, it becomes very important for this U.S. Supreme Court to empower the red states, or all states now, to be able to keep voters from going to the polls. So when you take Section 4 out of all this, Section 5 becomes irrelevant. And for the U.S. Supreme Court to suggest, well, gee whiz, these Section 5 predicates are ridiculous. They have to be revisited. Well, no, they're not ridiculous. As a matter of fact, the Senate and Congress reviewed them for days and weeks and months on end. And they took in testimony, hours and days of testimony, where it became very apparent to them that racism is still alive and well in these suspect jurisdictions like Florida, like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Texas, South Carolina, everywhere you would expect it. And they said, we're so concerned but that we want this law to stay intact until 2031, because the experts came in and testified in front of Congress and said, we don't see any dramatic change until there's a demographic change.
Right.
So this is the Supreme Court.
15,000 pages of testimony.
Right, right. So the Supreme Court now comes to the aid. And again, you have to look at this through their eyes. These are corporatist judges. Take the ideology out of it, Tom. Take Republican ideology out of it, except for this fact. Corporate America requires that Republicans be in office. And this is a court that has always done the bidding for corporate America, as we've seen on the other decisions that they reached in the last week. It's deplorable decisions.
Paul Weyrich was the guy who co-founded the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC, the was one of the founders, I believe, of the Heritage Foundation, certainly was there for that era. The Cato Institute, I mean, all the, and was in charge of the direct mail for the Reagan campaign in the 1980 election. One of the founders of the modern Republican Party. And I'm sorry? In the fall of 1980, as Ronald Reagan is running for president, Paul Weyrich spoke to a group of Republican Christian activists in a church in Dallas, Texas. Here's what he had to say that has now reached super fulfillment in the Supreme Court today. Here's Paul Weyrich.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
There you go.
Well, you can bet that these five Supreme Court justices are well aware of Weyrich's position. But again, Sam, I think what's so important is not to miss the connection. We look at everything from political ideology. We say, gee whiz, I'm Democrat, therefore I have these ideological values. You're Republican, therefore you have these ideological values. But the most salient value that this court is trying to protect is the corporate ideology. And they do that by keeping this new demographic shift from taking place, by keeping people from voting.
Yeah. And speaking of the corporate demographic, we've got a Canadian corporation. An interesting story I was reading this morning. They've at an 8,000 foot elevation in Utah, I believe it is. There's another Canadian corporation called U.S. something or other, something like U.S. Energy, but they got U.S. in the name. But it's a Canadian corporation digging up oil sands, tar sands, in Utah. But you got this Trans Canada with the Keystone Pipeline. President Obama mentioned today that he would veto it if it was determined that it wasn't in the national interest. That he would approve it if it was in the national interest and it didn't increase net carbon emissions. And the State Department, I believe, has already issued a preliminary report basically saying it is in the national interest and it doesn't raise carbon emissions.
Right.
So
yeah, writings on it. Tom, you probably wouldn't like what I have to say about what I observed about the speech that Obama gave.
Well, I think I might have just shared it with you.
Okay. Well, so having said that, we can't miss the story behind the story. Look, this is an administration that has allowed the oil industry to not only resume, to just speed up the permitting process for deep water drilling. It's a president that caved in on MACT, which is M-A-C-T. That's to reduce emissions of mercury and arsenic that reaches our children's lungs from virtually every power plant in the country. It's an administration that has embraced fracking. It's an administration that we still don't know why he won't just come out and say, look, I'm going to permit Keystone to take place, that we've been strung on. And so it's an administration that we've missed something here. And they've used the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs very, very astutely, Tom. Every time this administration has even come out with something that looks like an executive order, it's been pitched over to the OIRA, and it falls into a black hole. It disappears. It disappears for years. Matter of fact, there's about 120 rule-making kind of decisions that have come not just from this administration, but all the way back to Bush that have sat in this black hole called the OIRA.
What is the OIRA?
It's called the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. It is the place where an administration is able to do this. Here's how it works. The administration goes on the air and they say, you know, I feel your pain. I'm there for you. I want this change to take place. And what they actually end up doing is they may sign in a law, but then they say, we're going to have to send it over to OIRA for a review. And they take hearings. They can delay it forever. It is a black hole. And what this allows, what this allows is for industry to come in and pitch and pitch and pitch their side of the story and delay any.
So this is the equivalent of lobbying Congress.
Well, of course.
Only they're lobbying the White House about executive orders.
Well, that's exactly right. It also comes from Congress, too. Bills come out of Congress, and this is kind of a safe haven for a president who says, gee whiz, I've done everything I'm supposed to do. The OIRA has it. I don't know what's happening. But my point being, Tom, this is an administration who's talked a lot about real change, and I haven't really seen it yet.
We're all holding our breath here, Pat. Or maybe we shouldn't be. I don't know.
I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful too. I am hopeful.
You know, I thought, okay, he's after the election. You know, he's got nothing to lose now. Well, we'll see. We'll see. He still hasn't made a decision on Keystone, so. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
At ringoffireradio.com. Check out Pap's website. And thank you, Pat, for being with us. Twenty minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Bill in St. Helens, Oregon, listening on the WCPT stream. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. Hey, give me about 1 minute to get through this.
Sure.
A little earlier, you started out with, you were saying that, you know, the intent of the founders was that the three branches essentially were independent, and then very shortly later in the discussion, you were basically interpreting Article 3, Section 2 to give Congress the right to control the courts and tell the courts how to do their business. So let's go back to that thinking. Let me go through this. So let's read, I think you're being a little bit casuist in the way you're reading two different sections. First, Section 2, I'm going to read it the way I would read it if I was going to argue that they did have original jurisdiction on laws. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising as constitutional. Let's stop, go back to the beginning of that. The judicial power shall extend to the laws of the United States and treaties made. So see, I could read where, well, they can review the laws, but don't, not yet. Now, let's go down to in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and councils and those, blah, blah. That entire paragraph is talking about jurisdiction, and it clearly forbids the Congress from touching original jurisdiction. And reading it as a simple person, I know not everybody reads it this way, I'm reading it and saying, hey, in all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction. Now, what are we talking about? Appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions under such regulations as the Congress shall make. So I'm total agreement that Congress can modify, they could make appellate jurisdiction original jurisdiction. They can't make original jurisdiction appellate. They could make laws about what type of appellate jurisdiction the Supreme Court had. No disagreement. But that to me is, I don't see where. I cannot even possibly interpret that to give Congress a blank check to write any laws they want about the court. Any more than I think you can argue that the first section I read gives the Congress the right to, you know, determine whether or not a law is constitutional.
I understand your argument. I really do, Bill. And in fact, you would probably find a fascinating read, Larry Kramer's book. Larry is, maybe he isn't now, but when he wrote the book, he was the dean of the Stanford Law School. And he wrote a book called The People Themselves, and which was Jefferson's response to Spencer Roane. You know, who should have that power? The people themselves. And he lays out both sides of the judicial review argument, the argument that the Supreme Court should have the right of judicial review. And you find a certain amount of ambiguity in Hamilton's writings when you get into Federalist, 78 through 82, as I recall, is the stuff that has to do with the judiciary. And he talks about how the Supreme Court will be the most harmless, the judiciary will be the most harmless of all the branches. They don't have the power to tax. They don't have the power to raise an army. They don't have the power to have a police force of their own. They basically are simply the final court of appeals. And then in another point he makes, you could argue that what he's saying is, by the way, they have the power to interpret the Constitution and keep Congress honest. But the way that this has played out over the years, particularly since Marbury, I think you would have a hard time arguing, Bill, that this hasn't functionally turned the United States into a constitutional monarchy.
Tom, I'm in agreement with you, but I'm in total disagreement with you on one other aspect.
Okay, well, let me just give you a caveat to that that you may find useful. In other words, let me make your argument, only from a different direction. Congress clearly has the power to regulate the Supreme Court. That's Article 3, Section 2. The number of justices, for example, on the court is determined by Congress. It's changed a half a dozen times over the course of our history. When Franklin Roosevelt was trying to change the court, he was trying to say anybody over the age of 70, all of the justices over 70 create in aggregate have one vote. They should be called justices emeritus. I mean, there's a lot of different ways Congress can regulate the court without regulating what the court can rule on. So if you were to say that Congress can regulate the court, well, no, actually, my argument just kind of disintegrated in front of me. Yeah, never mind. It's not going to work. I'm going down a logical rabbit hole here.
Yeah, and then you keep on giving one other option, and this is kind of going a bad place, but you keep giving another option saying, well, we can vote them out. And I personally...
Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm sorry, Bill, just very quickly. Okay. What Congress could do is they could say that they could limit the term of the justices so that, you know, they're not there forever. They could, they could put the age restriction on them like Roosevelt did. I mean, there are things that Congress could do to make turnover in the court more rapid, and that turnover in the court would then cause the court to be a little more responsive to public opinion.
I actually wrote a constitutional amendment and submitted it to 50 states' legislatures suggesting term limits on the courts. Basically, the gist of it is every 12 years, every midterm election, you would, the states would submit, state legislatures would submit a candidate for the Supreme Court. And I had some controls in there so it wasn't swayed too big in the part of the main big states. And
right. And
what would happen is every 4 years, midterm election, the top three vote getters from the 50 states would become the new members of the Supreme Court, and the top three most senior Supreme Court justices, determined by time in office only, would go away. So basically every midterm, you would replace four justices, and so every 12 years you would replace the Supreme Court in its entirety. And in the event of a justice dying, retiring, or being removed from office, you'd fall back to the old president with the advice and consent of the Senate. However, that candidate would fall into the slot of the slot vacated and accept the majority status of that slot. So short term, you would have an appointee. Long term, you would have essentially elected people. But going back to my original thing on...
But here's the question. How do we overcome the kingdom stuff? How do we overcome the fact that what we have right now is functionally a constitutional monarchy, not a democratic republic?
I wish I had an answer. And the one answer is the voting box. But, like I said, I'm 63. I've been following this stuff for all the years I've been around. And we've now gotten to the point in our, there's been corruption in government since the beginning. We all can agree to that, I think. But nowhere before in our history do I believe that government corruption had the power to destroy our economy, destroy our world, our climate. Nowhere in our history has the government had such power to literally destroy this nation and the world. And the idea that somehow every 4 years, 2 years, 4 years, we're going to vote for a couple of people. I'm always going to put my guy back in office, by the way, and get rid of him. I got it. So I said, option number two is, why are armed forces obeying unconstitutional orders? They took an oath to the Constitution. And when they're told to do something that flies in the face of the Constitution...
Well, because it hasn't been struck down by the Supreme Court, so they're asserting that it's constitutional. Which gets to the issue of, what does the court grant cert to and what gets before the court to begin with. But, Bill, lots of good stuff to talk about. We'll continue this conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, thoughts on what we should do in response to a Supreme Court out of control? Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. There is a live filibuster of the Texas anti-abortion bill going on in Texas right now. Pull up the audio out of my computer.
That we should have to choose between women's health and the traditions of the Texas Senate. The traditions of the Texas Senate actually in the regular session assured that differing perspectives on women's health were made a part of the legislative decision-making that occurred here.
This is Senator Wendy Davis, State Senator Wendy
Davis.
And
when I talk about abuse of power...
Democrat from Fort Worth.
I don't believe that in a little d democratic state, an individual should have the opportunity and the ability to override the expressed desires, thoughts, concerns, interests of people that are represented by the 31 senators here on the Senate floor.
Well, Senate Bill 5...
And I believe... Let me finish answering you. And I believe that in the regular session...
We'll go back. So this is extraordinary. This woman, State Senator Wendy Davis, is single-handedly... She's doing a 12-hour filibuster. Single-handedly filibustering this bill where the... When another state representative, one of the sponsors of the bill, was asked why there should be no exemption or exception for women who have been raped, she said, well, because they've got this rape kit in the emergency rooms of hospitals, and you can go into the hospital and get yourself cleaned out. Or women can go to the hospital and get themselves cleaned out. Like, she thinks that, one of the sponsors of this bill, who is a woman, by the way, actually believed that rape could be magically reversed by simply going into the hospital and being hooked up to some kind of giant vacuum cleaner or something. Or scrub-a-dub. When in fact what a rape kit is it's just a set of Q-tips, basically. It's a couple of swabs and some envelopes for and test tubes for fingernail scrapings and pubic hair and evidence in the underwear and for swabbing the bodily orifices to look for evidence of another person's DNA, the rapist's DNA. It does absolutely nothing to prevent a pregnancy. You want to prevent a pregnancy, you got to take Plan B. You got to take morning after pill. Which actually could have been a little more rational answer to that question, I suppose. Although I doubt that the Texas representative is in favor of the morning after pill either. So what can you do? But so anyway, that's going on. And I'm going to get to your calls here on the Supreme Court and what in just a second. But I just wanted to point out a couple of other quick news stories that it's important, I think, get on the record. Number two, the IRS's internal investigation into what happened with the so-called Tea Party so-called scandal has been completed and submitted. And it turns out that the IRS wasn't just pulling out groups who had name Tea Party in them. They were pulling out groups who, any group that had the word progressive in their name, Israel in their name, Occupy in their name. They were subjecting them to additional scrutiny, and they had actually several others as well, that they were looking for flags that the groups were engaging in what should be considered political activity rather than social welfare activity. So Daryl Issa is blown up. So how does he respond to this report going public? Benghazi! No, I'm not making this up. He actually started tweeting about Benghazi today. Daryl Issa is back to Benghazi. Oh, we got to find something we can impeach this guy over. It's really kind of tragic. President Obama gave a major climate speech. It was a good start and an important speech. And therefore, CNN gave it 8 minutes. Fox News gave it 4 minutes. MSNBC gave it 41 seconds. And the Weather Channel gave it 49 minutes. Now, why would they do that at the Weather Channel? Well, maybe because they covered the consequences of global climate change. Makes sense to me. Marcy, in Burnsville, Minnesota, listening on KTNF.
How you doing? It's Maurice.
Oh, Maurice. I'm sorry. My dyslexia got me. Actually, Anyhow, what's up, Maurice?
How you doing, sir? Well, you hit so many good points today. I'm just going to start with what I originally called with again. And it comes down to exactly what you said. It's us. It's the people. And we are at the time right now where it's just dire. All this talking, all these smart big words, that's not going to help us. We are in a state right now where you asked why, you know, there was corruption in the government before. Well, now the government is not even the government anymore. It is run by the corporations. And we're going to end up in a state where it was like RoboCop. The corporation is the government.
Yes.
And we're allowing them to do that. They're reading us. They're watching everything. And if we continue to sit back by iPads and watch reality TV and watch people being ignorant and don't care what's going on, sir, we are done for as a people. And it's going to be the American government, not the American people.
I agree with you. By the way, Senator Patrick Leahy, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and a former federal prosecutor, Senator Patrick Leahy, the Democrat from Vermont, has introduced a bill that would put an end, an earlier end, this is from a piece by Alex Kane over on Alternate, to provisions in the FISA amendment bill that authorized the Internet surveillance project known as PRISM, which is the project, the whole thing that Snowden revealed. But I'm with you. I think that, frankly, what this all has to do with is the power of money in politics. And the only way we're going to get money out of politics is to say that the Supreme Court, and again, the curse in America has been the Supreme Court since 1803, in my opinion, and in the Marbury decision, the Supreme Court invented out of whole cloth. I mean, the kings and queens on the Supreme Court, actually, it was always historically the kings. Queens have never voted for it, to the best of my. Well, I don't know. Actually, maybe Sandra Day O'Connor would have supported it. But in any case, the royalty on the Supreme Court have said that corporations are people. And money is speech. And no legislature has ever said that. No president has ever said that, other than, you know, the attempted president, Mitt Romney. And that doctrine is what is corrupting America. And the only way to get that out, assuming the Congress is not going to step up and regulate the Supreme Court, I don't believe that they're going to do it. I think they should, but I don't think they're going to do it. The only way to get that out is to insert into the Constitution an explicit statement that money is not speech and that corporations are not people, which is why you should go to movetoamend.org and sign up, create a local group out of your home and get people involved. Maurice, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Matthew in Sterling, Virginia. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just want to go back to your point about, you know, the Russians and how we respecting the transit lounge and how we do the same thing.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's not true in my personal experience. I had a Russian girlfriend, and I was going to meet her in Jamaica, and I kind of wanted to meet her on the way going down there. Mm-hmm. And I was looking into it, and she would have to get a transit visa even if she was not going through customs or immigration at all, even if she was just going into the transit lounge and getting on another flight going down to Jamaica.
For less than a 24-hour period. Because Russia requires it if you're going to be there more than 24 hours. They require a transit visa as well.
No, this was even under 24 hours.
Really?
If she was going to be there for just 2 hours to change planes, just simply to change planes, she had to get a transit visa.
Now, what does this say about the United States of America, Matthew, about what we've become, that A, Russia has a more restrictive transit visa policy than we do, and B, that we've become the country that leakers, not the country that leakers flee to, as we used to be, but the country that leakers flee from?
Well, there's also another, even more...
Or whistleblowers, I should say, excuse me.
Yeah, it's pretty bad, I think, but there's an even more egregious case where we actually arrested a Muslim scholar, not even a terrorist or anything like that, and in the transit lounge on his way from the Middle East to Canada. He never went through immigration, never went through customs, and we arrested him out of the transit lounge. I don't remember the details. I don't remember the name, so I'm sure you can look it up.
Yeah.
Because the guy eventually went to court, and I think he won and finally got back to Canada. But he had health problems or something like that. I forget exactly what the instance was, but I do remember that he was plucked out of the transit lounge. He was not even going through immigration or customs. He was just changing planes.
I wonder if there are international standards for this, Matthew. If there are, you know, if Russia is the standard and we're the outlier, or if we're the standard and Russia is the exception.
That would be pretty interesting. I've been over there three times, so it's kind of interesting seeing the differences that I run into,
mm-hmm.
Security and things like that. So.
Yeah, I've been to Russia several times since the fall of the Soviet Union, and I was in East Germany before the fall of the Soviet Union, but never the Soviet Union, Russia per se. And but you do have to get a visa to go there You know, they as an American.
Yes.
Or at least you had to back. The last time I was there was maybe 10 years ago. So.
Yeah, I was there last year, and you still have to get a visa.
Yeah.
To get into Russia, and they tend to mimic what we require from them. They mimic and say, hey, you know, you have to meet this requirement. Because I was looking at the form, and they wanted to know where my mother was born.
Yeah, a lot of countries are doing that. You know, when we started, when we clamped down on, I think it was Brazil and Canada, you know, after 9/11, we put up certain barriers, and like you had to have a passport to go into Canada. Canada starts saying, okay, you got to have a passport to go into the, you know, to come into Canada, whatever. Thank you, man.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I meant to say you have to have a passport for Canadians to come into the United States. They were saying, okay, you're going to have a passport to come into Canada. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Talk Radio News will not be with us today. It's not because I told Victoria she was using the word, oh. Okay, all right, good. Nate in Boring, Oregon. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the congressional monarchy, as you put it.
Yeah, constitutional monarchy.
I think,
yeah,
there should be term limits of some sort for Supreme Court justices. Maybe three presidents after, a maximum of three presidents after they're appointed.
No, that's an idea. I liked, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, I thought, actually had a pretty good idea, which is that all you don't want to silence the justices after they're 70 years old. But what you do is you aggregate all of them together and it becomes one vote. And so they, you know, they vote as a block. And if they all agree on something or a majority of them agree on something, then that becomes the vote of the justice emeritus, which is reflected by the 1, 2, 3, 4 at the time that he was doing it. I think there were either 4 or 5 members of the court that were over 70. And so they have one vote, which means that you're bringing new people on. It also provides an incentive to the president to appoint people to the court who are younger so that they'll have a longer time on the court before they hit 70. But that incentive already exists. But, yeah, serve under three presidents. I mean, these are all things Congress could pass laws to this effect tomorrow.
One that appoints them. So, you know, a maximum of up to maybe even 30 years. But, a minimum of... Or it could be as few as 14 to 16 years.
Yeah. No, it's an idea. Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Howard in New York City. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. First, if you give me 30 seconds, I'd like to summarize sort of what you've been saying in the news for the past 13 years. So can I just hang in a few seconds?
Okay.
There are these two planets, like in solar system, two planets. And one planet says the other planet, God, you look awful. So the planet responds, I feel terrible. So the first planet says, well, what's wrong? So the second planet says, I don't know. I'm told I have human beings. So the first planet says, don't worry about it. I'm told they don't last long. So Unfortunately, that's become my view. I think we're so far out in left field, I don't see any way to get back. I tried when Bear Stearns went under, I knew that there was a Citibank and its mortgage delinquency quadrupled. I try to call the Times, emails, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing with Tarpon. So I've gotten no place on and off over 4 years. So here's an idea, the only idea I've sort of been able to come up with. We have something that money really can buy, and that's Hollywood. Now, I know Hollywood is progressive, but...
Somewhat.
Look,
there are plenty of conservatives in Hollywood, too.
I'm sorry?
There are plenty of conservatives in Hollywood, and there's a very, very strong corporatist streak in Hollywood, but yeah.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm saying, if you could get all of the talent there, and somebody's got to coordinate it, I can't tell you who, and then you go out and you do demonstrations that literally can impact millions of people. So if you had great, you know, like almost a Woodstock, but you have one every month, and what you do then is you appeal not to the... to the, you know, what we're all for America, but you appeal to people's individual greed. Like, if you want to save $50 billion out of the Defense Department, we will take that $50 billion and we'll put it towards cancer research because 15 million have cancer and at a food stamp program. So you tell each group and you take a look at maybe 15 different groups and you say, if you vote, So if you contact your congressman, we will give you specifically what you, John Q. Smith, what you need. Mm-hmm. So now the people will be voting based on their own private needs, based on greed. But you need, somebody's got to organize a Woodstock every month, and not only Hollywood could do that, but that's all I've been able to come up with.
Yeah. I mean, Howard, what you're suggesting is a variation on Ralph Nader's, you know, only the rich can save us. He wrote an entire book saying this. And I consider that to be salvationist thinking. It's you know, looking for some external force, you know, the rich people, the Hollywood, whatever, to save society. I think that we have to save ourselves. I'm with Jefferson on this stuff. Power has to flow from the bottom up. It has to be from the people out. And then Hollywood will start making movies that reflect what we're saying. And then Congress will start passing laws, you know, hopefully, that reflect what we're saying. Or at least, you know, lame ducks, you know, lame duck presidents would start making policies that reflect what we're saying. But we've got to form these coalitions. This is the conversation Joe Madison and I were having in the first half hour. It's time to do coalition building. It's time to do movement politics. It's time to pull all this stuff together. Howard, I get your point, and I think it's a good one. But I would like to take it a step farther and say, let's start with us. Thank you for your call. Andy in Redlands, California. Hey, Andy. What do you think we should do about an out-of-control SCOTUS?
Hi, Tom. I just want to just say a comment on the Supreme Court. I think we should all just go out and protest. We should have mass protests.
Well, you know, the court just banned protests on their own property last week.
Doesn't matter. We should still do it.
Which I think is a violation of the First Amendment right to peaceably assemble and petition your government for redress of grievances. It's amazing that the Shano, do you know the details of this when the court banned? Yeah. Okay. All right. I got to track that down because I saw the story. I saw this little story like in the New York Times or something. It's like, you know, the Supreme Court bans protests on its own steps or something.
That's unfortunate. I mean, we should still go out there and you know, protest. That's all right.
Yeah.
Every other countries, the Brazil, Turkey, they're having mass protests. I mean, I don't understand why the United States isn't ready to.
Well, you know who's driving those mass protests in Brazil and in Turkey are labor unions.
Okay.
And we don't have labor unions anymore. I mean, you know, the labor unions that we have are you know, kind of pale and sickly. They're these fragile remnants of what we used to have. It's really a tragic and unfortunate thing, but 32 years of Reaganomics, Reagan's war on organized labor, has you know, just stripped. I mean, they've killed off 2/3 of the labor unions in this country, and now they're going after the post office, the largest unionized employer in the United States. They want to kill off another half or a third of our, not just the post office, obviously, but in other places of our unionized workers. So, Andy, thanks for the call. Excellent point. We will be back. It is, it's 57 minutes past the hour, coming up on the top of the hour here. We will continue the conversation. Can Congress please regulate the Supreme Court? Please? Stick with it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. So I brought it up and we started poking around. Don't Tase Me, Bro pointed it out in the chat room. Sue shared the details. Shano tracked them down on the internet, on the Supreme Court's site. And let me just, I mean, this is how out of control our Supreme Court has become. And after a short rant about that, I want to talk about Mr. Snowden and what he has been reminding us of. And Booz Allen Hamilton. Did you know that they're owned by Carlyle Group, which is owned in part by the Bin Laden family? Yes, the Bin Laden family has your phone calls. Well, no. Maybe they don't. They own the company that owns the company that has your phone calls. Okay, anyhow. The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was ratified on December 15th, 1791. Says, it's one sentence, one long sentence. It is headlined, Freedom of Religion Speech in the Press, Rights of Assembly and Petition. And here it is. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, semicolon, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, semicolon, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Grievances. Right there in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law to prohibit the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Allow me to read to you from the website of the United States Supreme Court a regulation put into place effective 2 weeks ago. Today is June 25th. This was effective June 13th. This is our Supreme Court in action. Now, let me preface this by saying that just a few months ago, I spoke at a demonstration in front of the Supreme Court against Citizens United and corporate personhood. Actually, it was more than a few months ago. It was maybe 6 months. It was damn cold that day. It was the middle of the winter. And I'm sure the video's out there on the webs, all over, you know, easily found, but we were standing on the, you know, in front of the Supreme Court and petitioning them for redress of grievances. They apparently didn't like that. So here's the new regulation effective as of 2 weeks ago. No person shall engage in a demonstration within the Supreme Court building and grounds. The term, quote, demonstration, end quote, includes... Now, remember, the First Amendment just said you have the right to peaceably assemble and petition your government for redress of grievances. The word demonstration includes demonstrations, picketing, speech-making, marching, holding vigils or religious services, and all other like forms of conduct that involve the communication or expression of views or grievances. I'm not making this up. You can find it on the Supreme Court's website. Is that scrotus.gov? Supremecourt.gov. Okay. Oh, there's no R in there? Oh, yeah, okay. This is incredible. President of the Rutherford Institution says, this is repugnant to the Constitution. If you believe in free speech, he said, the First Amendment's really clear. You have the right to petition your government peacefully to redress grievances. Mind-boggling. Okay. Equally mind-boggling. What you don't know, the take a left turn posting over Democratic Underground. This is actually a repost. Well, no, it's not a repost. It might be an original piece. Who points out that lost in the Edward Snowden debate is a critical look at his former employer, Booz Allen Hamilton. Okay, 99% of the revenue comes from the U.S. government, which includes the NSA, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and the IRS. What? In addition, Booz Allen is heavily connected to the CIA. So who's running this company that Edward Snowden blew the whistle on? Well, the current director of the National Intelligence is James Clapper, head of the NSA, the man who lied to Congress about the fact that NSA is actively spying on Americans. He happens to be a former executive of Booz Allen Hamilton. Mike McConnell, the current executive of the company, was the director of national intelligence during the George W. Bush administration. He worked for Booz Allen Hamilton before the Bush administration, then went to work for the as the director of national intelligence during the Bush administration, then went back to work for Booz Allen Hamilton after Bush left office, and that's where he is now. James Woolsey, former CIA director, current executive with Booz Allen Hamilton. This is the guy who was, like, you know, all gung-ho about wars. I mean, James Woolsey is like the neocon's neocon. Melissa Hathaway, former executive, also worked for McConnell during the Bush administration. Ian Brzezinski, former executive at Booz Allen, son of Zbigniew Brzezinski. David Zakheim. And they go through his biography. Most recently, he was an advisor on Middle East policy to Mitt Romney. That was in 2012. 2004, actually. He started working for Booz Allen Hamilton. Booz Allen Hamilton is owned by the Carlyle Group. One of the big investors in the Carlyle Group was the Bin Laden family in Saudi Arabia. Yeah, that Bin Laden family. And instrumental in being the go-between between Carlyle and Bin Laden was a guy named George Herbert Walker Bush. Maybe you've heard of him? Writes, take a left turn over at Democratic Underground. The CEO of the Carlyle Group, remember they own Booz Allen Hamilton, is Frank Carlucci. He has quite a resume. He was the director of the Office of Economic Opportunity, the War on Poverty, place where you get to decide who gets government contracts during the Nixon administration. Deputy director of the CIA in the Carter administration, national security advisor and secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. His protege was a man named Donald Rumsfeld. And he has been with the Project for New American Century, PNAC, and remember the Board of Trustees for the RAND Corporation. Ed RAND especially was Middle Eastern policy. And it goes on and on. It just gets very, 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 very thick. A lot of links there. And then, finally, take a break from the Snowden drama so far to consider what he has revealed. Katharina, posting over at Democratic Underground. A publication of Snowden's leaks began with a top-secret order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court sent to Verizon on behalf of the NSA, demanding the cell phone records of all Verizon Business Network Services American customers for the three-month period ending in July. The order obtained by The Guardian sought only the metadata for those millions of users' calls, who called whom, when, and from what locations, but specifically requested Americans' records, disregarding foreigners despite the NSA's legal restriction that it can only surveil non-U.S. persons.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So let us not forget what Mr. Snowden is saying in the midst of all the hysteria about where he might be. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. The Tom Hartman Program. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, listening on XM, Sirius XM Radio. Hey, Hack, what's up?
Hey, how much you want to bet that the righties are not screaming judicial activism?
Yeah, I'll bet they're not. I would not. No. Yeah. So, should they be?
If they weren't the lying, weaselly hypocrites that they are, yeah, they probably should be. If they should be against judicial activism, they should be against all judicial activism. But, yeah, righties are a fickle bunch.
Yeah, there you go. I think you got it, Hack. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Steven, in New York City, listening to WWRL. Hey, Steven.
Hi, Tom. I called a while back about the line item veto. You told me that it was illegal. And they passed a law because they say that the president would be basically passing laws.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the Supreme Court struck it down.
Right. The Supreme Court just did that, a line item veto on that voters' law, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
And that essentially...
Yeah, they did. They just, you're right.
So wouldn't that be illegal for them to do it, too?
Stephen, that is absolutely brilliant. Stephen, you are going to get a free copy or an autographed free copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision by Tom Hartman. Shano tells me that you're our book winner for the day. Is that all right with you?
that's fine with me. Okay. I have one other thing to say, though. The first line of the Constitution that you just read, it should read, all branches of this government shall not pass any laws, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because when you say Congress shall pass no law, it's not stopping the Supreme Court from passing these laws, because I guess they didn't see that.
Or at least a regulation, yeah.
From the bench.
Yeah, I don't know how a regulation has the force. Oh, Congress gave them the authority. Shano says that the Congress gave the Supreme Court the authority to regulate their own grounds, and so they came up with this regulation saying that if you hold a grievance, you can't. Which the First Amendment protects. Amazing, Stephen. I'm gonna put you on hold. He's on line two, Danielle, and we're gonna send him a copy of Cracking the Code. George in Santee, California. Hey, George, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's in your mind?
Hey, you're welcome, Tom. Love the show, especially the call-ins.
Thank you.
I have a question about the way the Supreme Court is set up. You know, it's the third branch of the government, along with the legislative and the judicial, or the legislative and executive. Why is it that we can't vote him in and then also vote him out when we need? Because it seems like to me the country's trying to move a progressive.
Yeah.
But boy, that's just a big, you know, big speed bump in the road for us.
When the Constitution was written, this was a giant experiment. It had been thousands of years, several thousand years, since there was another, you know, a previous experiment in democracy in Greece, and or arguably at a republic in Rome, 2,000 years since the Roman Republic, 3,000 years since the Greek democracy. And the consensus of most of the world was that it would not succeed. And when it looked like it did succeed, then some other countries said, oh, we got to do this just, you know, tomorrow morning. Like, you know, and then you had the French Revolution and things, you know, which is, I don't mean to be a simplified history. The French Revolution is far more complex than that. But the point is that there were people at the Constitutional Convention writing the Constitution who weren't really all that certain that that a lot of democracy was a good idea. And this is why, for example, there is no, well, actually, this is part of why there's no right to vote for president of the United States in the Constitution. Instead, we vote for an electoral college, and those electors can cast their votes for the president regardless of who elected them or regardless of the will of the people who elected them, which is something that I think should be done away with. But the electoral college, in part, was because, you know, it takes a couple of days for people to travel across the country, and they wanted to have communities elect wise elders to go to D.C. and come up with, you know, who's the best president. But in larger part, the Electoral College was put together because too much democracy might be kind of dangerous. I mean, this was basically the perspective of what became the Federalists. And lots of democracy is a great thing was what became the perspective of what became the Democratic Republicans, Jefferson's party. And Jefferson and Madison and Mason and Monroe and on and on went. And so, you know, they looked at this and they said, okay, well, how do we compromise on this? Well, okay, let's have the justices of the Supreme Court not be elected at all, but have them appointed by the person who is the most distant or confirmed by the people who are the most distant from the people. The senators are only elected every 6 years, and appointed by the person who's middle distant from the people. The president's only elected every 4 years, and have the people who are directly elected by the people and subject to their vote every 2 years, which is the House of Representatives. Every single member of the House stands for re-election every 2 years. Have them have no say in it whatsoever. And so the idea was, you know, we'll have at least one branch of government that's kind of insulated, that's well insulated, just in case this whole democracy thing turns out not to have been such a brilliant idea. And I think you could argue there was a mistake. But on the other hand, when you look at those states and municipalities that elect their judges, these are the places where you have some of the most corrupt judges in America. Because what happens is corporate interests, fat cats, local land barons or, you know, big corporations, in some cases foreign corporations, come in and pour, but they have a local factory, in the United States, just pour enormous amounts of money into these judicial elections to get their toadies elected to the courts. And this is a growing corruption problem in the United States. And it all, again, comes out of the doctrine that money is speech, therefore it's possible to do this, and corporations are people, therefore they can participate. So, George, I would be very wary of an elected Supreme Court as long as our electoral process is so corrupt right now. Am I making sense?
Well, I just believe that those five conservatives on there would not be there if we were getting to vote, especially Clarence Thomas and the scandal he had with secretary came forward with all that stuff.
Yeah,
because I believe her side of the story, honestly.
Oh, you're talking
very credible.
Yeah, are you talking about Anita Hill, who was talking about Clarence Thomas?
Anita Hill, yes.
Yeah. I could be. On the other hand, it could be that enough money would have been dropped into the election campaigns to make you think that these people are just walking on water. I mean, keep in mind, Mitt Romney got just about half of the American vote. So, George, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Bottom line, I mean, as long as you've got a couple of justices in the Supreme Court attending gigs put on by the Koch brothers, you've got a problem. The good, the bad, and the very, very oxycanthously ugly, brought to you by Edison Factor, food for your brain, edisonfactor.com. The good, Houston. Yes, Houston, Texas. Last week, the Texas city announced a plan to purchase $2 million worth of renewable energy from the local power giant Reliant Energy. The deal will provide over 140 megawatts of clean energy to the residents of the country's fourth biggest city. It will make Houston the number one municipal buyer of clean power in the United States. Any city that takes such a bold step toward reducing fossil fuel dependency should be commended for its actions, especially if, like Houston, so much of its wealth comes from the fossil fuel industry to begin with. Good work, Houston. The bad. Ben Stein. During a recent appearance on Cavuto on Business, the conservative pundit and former Nixon speechwriter denied the existence of climate change and called anti-global warming activists terrorists. Yes, terrorists. Check it out.
The real problem is, do we really know that this is hurting
right,
the Earth?
Right.
The science is not 100% unanimous, despite what the global warming skeptics and terrorists would tell us, or global warming terrorists would tell us. The science is not clear on this, and I just don't think we should be going all out on this until the science is completely clear.
They said they're about tobacco, too. Sorry, Ben. Well, and in fact, they're the same scientists in many cases. While there may be some outlier scientists who are funded by the fossil fuel industry who don't think global warming is a problem, the vast majority of the scientific community said for years that climate change is both real and a huge threat to all life on Earth, just like smoking causes cancer. And when you compare activists to terrorists, well, you just sound like your old boss, Tricky Dick Nixon. And that's just terrifying. And the very, very ugly Stan Solomon. During a recent broadcast of his television show, the conservative pundit made some, bizarre comments about President Obama. Check this out.
Barack Obama is a wussy guy who throws a ball like a girl, who everyone knows was involved in homosexuality. And I think he is the stereotypical, if he could get away with it, he'd be in drag. I don't think he's a man at all.
Right, Stan. And he was born where? Not only is what you said about the president completely inaccurate, it's also very, very ugly. And even if it was accurate, it couldn't be accurate. You can't mix up the way somebody throws a ball with all those stereotypes and all those. That's just ugly. There's just no other way to say it. Mike in Vail, Arizona. Hey, Mike. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. I called last week and I caught you right before break. So I just wanted to kind of touch bases and finish the thesis of my call. Mm-hmm. I've come to the point, the realization in my mind that, I wonder if the world is going to begin to, push back against America due to our carelessness and whether it's economic policies, whether it's the illegal wars. We're turning the pages back on civil rights and the middle class and all the things that scored us so many points, if you will, in the world theater.
And again, you know, I just wonder, because, you know, so many of your callers are into it. They're aware of what's going on. You know, the rest of the world, I think your term was, they look at us like our crazy Aunt Betty or something. You know, we're slow in getting there. We're slow in waking up. And so at what point, Tom, does this become a national security issue for America?
Oh, I think it became a national security issue several decades ago. From the bombing of the embassy in Lebanon to 9/11, to the bombing in Boston. I mean, they don't represent the sentiment of the world as a whole, and they certainly don't represent the sentiments of the majority of people in the world. It's a small minority. But these kinds of things are not happening to Canada. These kinds of things are not happening to Ireland. You know, they're not happening to France. These are the early warning signs. These are the fever before the infection. These are the signs that our foreign policy, the way that we behave around the world, is not good for us. And so I would say it's already started, Mike. And the fact that now, you know, Edward Snowden goes out and blows the whistle on what's going on at Booz Allen Hamilton, a.k.a. Carlisle and Bin Laden, and over at the NSA. And then, you know, the president of the United States says to China and Russia, would you please arrest this guy? And they say, you know, basically, you know, thumb their nose at him. I think those are signs that we've gone around the curve somehow. And I think that we went past, I'm not sure it's a point of no return, but we went past a tipping point of some kind during the George W. Bush administration when we got genuinely crazy. Now, we had some, you know, we got a bad rap internationally as a result of the Vietnam War. We got a bad rap internationally as a result of Iran-Contra and the stuff that Reagan was doing. But this really pushed it over the top. And so, Mike, I think your point is a really good one, and we need to be looking at how the world is pushing back on us at us already. Thanks a lot for the call. And also look for the early warning signals within the United States, which I would say is a dysfunctional political system, an economy that's teetering, just waiting to fall over. You know, it's scary stuff. Eli, in Lake Station, Indiana, listening on WCPT. Hey, Eli, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
I had a comment earlier. You mentioned about Mitt Romney with the whole corporations are people thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I think that's like a play on words, because legally corporations are people, not corporations as in big corporations, but people whenever we're born. When we are given our birth certificate, pretty much using Capitis Diminishmus Maxima, they use our name in all capital letters to create a corporation underneath the Corporation of United States Incorporated, which was started in 1863 by a group of wealthy European bankers, pretty much.
Yeah, I've read the conspiracy theory on the internets. I respectfully disagree, Eli, and I think that it's the kind of stuff that paranoia is made of. But I know that it's out there. Thanks for sharing it with us. Frank in Montello, Wisconsin. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, you have information on the history of Supreme Court defiance?
Yeah, so it seems to me, and you'd probably know more about it than I would, but it seems that Andrew Jackson defied them back when
yes.
he was president.
Yes, what happened in that case was the Supreme Court said that his Trail of Tears program to export Cherokees out of Georgia and into Oklahoma was against the law and unconstitutional. I'm not even sure it said unconstitutional. Well, they may have. Who knows? But in any case, they ruled against him. And he said, Justice so-and-so has made his decision, and let him try to enforce it. And he just basically ignored what the Supreme Court said. Yes, Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, I got. I
think it was 1832, I think.
With all the talk about the Supreme Court, I was thinking, you know, they have been defied. And it seems earlier in our history it was defied by someone earlier, too. I don't think he was the first one to defy
the Supreme Court. That's the earliest. That's the, you know, that Lincoln defined the Supreme Court, basically defined Dred Scott, and and FDR trying to change the nature of the Supreme Court by having all justices over 70 be considered justices emeritus and aggregating them into one vote, but keeping them on the bench so that their wisdom would be there, their ability to influence others would be there. Those were the three cardinal events in the history of the court, as far as I know. Maybe there are others.
All right. Well, it's something to think about.
It would be, you know, of all people to defy the Supreme Court, right now we have in the White House a man who, A, is never going to run for re-election, and B, was a constitutional law professor. I would think that he would be the guy. And maybe what we should be doing is putting petitions over it at the White House website to say, you know, hey, how about defying the Supreme Court? Pull an Andrew Jackson on them. Or, you know, can you by executive order or some, you know, in some way bring back, although I don't think that it's possible, frankly, legally, to bring back Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. I think that I frankly don't think Congress is going to do anything between now and the election 2014, which makes it all the more important to get a Democratic majority in Congress in 2014 so that the Voting Rights Act can be brought back. Steve in Chicago, got a minute to the break. Steve, what's up?
Yes, this is a two-part question. Considering what we decided after World War II, that you can't say that they ordered me to kill people, you know, crimes against humanity, right?
Right.
Now, how can we be passing laws exempting people and corporations from knowingly killing people? How can we allow laws like that to be passed? And is it possible to pass a crimes against humanity law saying that all those decisions are null and void because you can't any more than you could after World
Which War killing of people are you talking about?
Crimes against humanity.
Steve, which are you talking about? Like drone strikes? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about products and
oh, GMOs and things.
The destruction of the environment, knowing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Steve, it's a good point. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It would be very interesting to see environmental laws pressed under international standards that have to do with human rights. I'm with you, Steve. Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, this is hysterical. I printed this out before I went on the air because I was going to go off on this story today. And we just, you know, got off on a Supreme Court tangent that I haven't quite left. But I see that somebody's calling about it. So let's let the caller set this thing up. Steve in Manhattan, listening on WWRL. Hey, Steve.
How are you?
I am great. You've got the story on this guy in China?
Yes. Chip Starnes. He's a guy who owns, co-owner of Specialty Medical Supplies. Mm-hmm. Makes like glucose monitors in his own factory. And he's being held hostage by 140 workers. They blocked his entrance, locked him in, hostage. I guess Ted Koppel will have his own gig back in Nightline, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty interesting. And so basically he wants to lay off 30 workers and transfer some of the labor, outsource it to India, Mumbai, India, where it's a little cheaper to manufacture things.
Right.
And there's a huge, and they're demanding severance package.
Right. And this is Chinese workers who have taken their boss hostage. Can you imagine if the American workers at, what was that company that Mitt Romney privatized? And Sensata, that's right. If the American workers of Sensata had taken their boss hostage, their new Chinese boss, I mean, it's incredible. And
so actually, if I was in China in 93, and that time is before economic boom, there's so much wealth in China, like people, one of the largest markets for supercars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's crazy over there. And it's like, there's so much poverty, so much pollution. They just dump everything. The oceans filled up with plastic, you know, pellets from, they make all the plastic, they make like iPhones goes into the ocean, Pacific Ocean, and all the fish are contaminated because all that manufacturing. Apparently, we just shift all our manufacturing to China. They didn't do anything about the environment. And all this stuff is going into the ocean and going even in the air and traveling to jet streams and affecting the health of Americans even.
Yeah, no, we get soot from Chinese power plants. You're right. But here the incredible irony of this, Steve, and you pointed it out, is that these Chinese workers, this is an American boss, so this presumably are jobs that would have been American jobs if we still had tariffs, because he wouldn't, you know, be able to manufacture overseas more cheaply than here in the United States. But because we don't have tariffs, and functionally really haven't had them since the Reagan administration, he just decided to go to China because the labor was cheaper there. And then after a couple of years in China, he decided to move his office to India because the labor was even cheaper there. And the Chinese workers said, oh, no, you don't. And they've got him locked in his office. And, you know, and in fact, here's a reporter, CBS News, got close enough to the building that they could stick a microphone up by the window. And he said, they're kind of holding me in a cage like an animal, Starnes shouted from behind a window to a reporter. And then the reporter said, well, can I help you escape? You want to make a run for it? And he said, it would probably be the wrong impression to give at this point in time. But I deserve the right to go back to my hotel room. I deserve to come back and we can address these things professionally. This is not how it's done. All right. I just find it so incredibly ironic. Steve, thanks for calling and pointing that out. Joe in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yeah, I just had a question on your opinion on an idea that I had here. What's your feeling on having the Supreme Court justices do a 9-year term, but every year you're having a new Supreme Court justice?
Oh, that's interesting. So every year of a person's presidency, they get to appoint a justice.
But then you're not stuck with someone for the 10, 20, maybe even 30 years.
Yeah, it would take 9 years for it to work. Well, actually, might that not freeze into place whatever the placement is at the time that the current justices retire? I mean, if you get two who retire this year and then 3 years goes by and then two retire, then the 9-year term would mean that whoever's president 9 years down from when the two retired in each of those instances would get to appoint two. So you'd have to kind of phase it in a way that ultimately the goal is to have a new justice appointed every year.
Yeah, and it would be locked to the year. So whether, you know, if someone only has a year left and whatever reason they're done, then
right.
They appoint someone. He's only in for that 1 year, and he can't get back in again. He's only
right.
To do, you know, that window of it. And I'm not sure.
That's a possibility. Again, that's the kind of regulation that Congress can make to control the nature and dynamics of the United States Supreme Court. And that's an interesting one. Joe, thanks for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Talk, and thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Warwick, Mass. Hey, Steve, what's up?
All right, Tom, I just got off with my senator. And
Elizabeth Warren?
Senator Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her about what that caller said about the line item veto.
Yeah.
They found it very interesting. They said they were going to contact her immediately.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So, you know, the meme moves on.
The Constitution on that ground there, what the court should have done was sent it back to the Congress for reconsideration.
Yeah, they should have either struck down the entire law or none at all. Yeah, very, very interesting. Steve, thanks for the call. And if they had struck down the entire law, boy, would it have gotten hot. Michelle in Carlton, Washington, you are on the air. Michelle, thank you for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just great.
I am so thankful for your program.
Well,
I've been listening to you for a long time, and
thank
I know we're probably running out of time.
Yeah, we have 1 minute till the end of the show. It's
what
yours.
What I wanted to talk about with you was, you know, the Supreme Court's been driving me crazy for the last, I don't know what, 6 years or whatever, and their decisions. I think that we should look at a class action suit against them as a group which has invaded our rights to free speech.
Well, except that 2 days ago, the Supreme Court made it harder for you to launch a class action lawsuit against anybody.
Well, I mean, I'm no lawyer, but it seems to me that what you said about them infringing our First Amendment rights on our property that surrounds their building is a clear infraction that is unconstitutional. I mean, it's like one and one is two.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, I'm no lawyer, so I can't do anything about it. But, boy, would I love to have a class action suit, and I'd sign up today for that suit.
There you go. I would join you, Michelle. Thank you for the call. Actually, you know, we have the ability to do class action suits against our political system. They're called elections. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll continue our conversation about the court. Will the kings and queens of the nation stand up for marriage equality? That's what's up next in all probability tomorrow. From the Supreme Court. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It takes all of us. It takes all of us participating. So check out some of the great progressive organizations out there and sign up. Help out. Daily Kos, by the way, has DailyKos.com has a petition for a right to vote. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.